You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Civil War ended over 150 years ago, but in many ways, the battle continues. A new book looks back at history and also contemporary affairs with the rise of white nationalism and the recent events that we saw in Charlottesville. It's by two Fresno State history professors, Ethan J. Keitel and Blaine Roberts. It's called Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy, a 150-year reckoning with America's original sin. Both Ethan and Blaine join us today. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I want to start out with the subject of your book and then work into the present day. Starting with you, Blaine, who was Denmark Vesey?
Denmark Vesey was born a slave. He lived in Charleston and ultimately was able to buy his freedom. He won the lottery in Charleston and used the proceeds from that lottery to buy his freedom. However, he was unable to free his family. And of course, he was very frustrated by that. He was very frustrated by the fact that he was living under a very oppressive white supremacist slave regime in Charleston. And so he and others decided to plan a slave insurrection. The plan was to rise up in the Charleston area and eventually set sail for Haiti. This slave insurrection was supposed to happen on Bastille Day, July 14th, 1822. However, the plot was foiled before it could be carried out, and city authorities ended up executing Vesey, as well as his co-conspirators, and selling several other participants outside the United States. So Denmark Vesey is a very famous, and to some people in Charleston, infamous black revolutionary. We should say that the book is not actually a biography of Vesey or even really a narrative about his plot. The reason that we put him in the title is that he really embodies one tradition of remembering slavery in Charleston. And that is what we call the unvarnished tradition. This is a memory that holds that slavery was central to the history of Charleston and the United States, that it caused the Civil War, and that it was a brutal, inhumane institution. And Denmark Vesey really embodies and encapsulates that memory. It was so brutal and so inhumane that he risked his life to try to burst the chains of the enslaved in Charleston.
And turning to you, Ethan, it seems like every generation we get new interpretations of history, new memories of the past, sometimes reinterpreted. And there's layers and layers of this story going back to the Civil War and then generations beyond. Help us peel back some of those layers now as Charleston history evolved. Take us to the immediate era after the Civil War. How was the community beginning to come to grips with what happened and its attitudes towards the now abolished original sin of America, and then we'll kind of walk it up to where we are now?
Sure, that's a great question. I want to just add on to what Blaine said, and as a way to get back to the beginning of what we write about. Our central theme in the book is that there's been a conversation going on, a debate, a fight, really, about the memory of slavery in Charleston for the last 150 years, and that there are two rival memories, an unvarnished memory, which is what Blaine was talking about, a memory of slavery as it really was in this brutal, awful, inhumane institution. But there's also been a whitewashed memory, something that was pushed by former slaveholders, their descendants, and others that sought to downplay the significance of slavery, say it was not that important to Charleston, to the state of South Carolina, to the United States as a whole, that minimized the significance of slavery to the coming of the Civil War, said it was about other things. And at times also that sold slavery as a positive thing, as a benign, if not beneficial institution, not just for slave owners, but also for the enslaved, that it civilized them. And that these rival memories have really been competing for the last 150 years. That's kind of our central argument. And so we do start this book at the end of the Civil War in 1865. And one of the most fascinating things that we really discovered as we were working on it is that we had expected that these whitewashed memories, which were really, really sort of took over the country in many ways by the early 20th century, we expected those to to really be the chief memory of slavery, the dominant, predominant memory of slavery in Charleston almost immediately after the Civil War. But that was not the case. In fact, unvarnished memories pushed by enslaved people themselves and their allies, Union soldiers who occupied the city of Charleston in 1865, Republican political party members, white and black, which controlled Charleston and the state of South Carolina in many ways for the decade after the Civil War during Reconstruction. They ensured that unvarnished memories of slavery couldn't be forgotten. They pushed them into the public sphere, held regular commemorations of slavery that were both joyous celebrations of an end of an awful thing, but at the same time underscored the pain. Things like a large parade in 1865 happens just a month after the fall of the city to Union forces. Thousands and thousands of enslaved people put on a huge parade through the center of town, miles long, and it featured a number of, you know, kind of remarkable things, but one was a mule-drawn cart that had a mock slave auction going on, and a man, a former slave himself, playing a slave auctioneer, asking who will bid on these people, and there were four former slaves pretending to be being put up for auction, and you know, to that, what that really did is capture that this was a painful thing that should be remembered as such, should not be forgotten for the destruction it did to families and individuals.
Does that narrative in any way mirror the Reconstruction era? And then after that, the rise of the Klan, the new Klan in that era, is there a parallel, a direct parallel there?
Absolutely, there's a parallel. So this real public display and recognition of the brutality of slavery was very predominant during Reconstruction. So the important kind of factor to keep in mind is that African Americans were politically empowered in South Carolina, particularly. They actually held a majority in the lower house of the state legislature throughout Reconstruction. So they, along with these white Republican allies who had come south, were really able to make sure that the truth about slavery remained in public view throughout Reconstruction. And that's a really important part of the story to know that that was the reality on the ground. But to your question, absolutely, it changes once Reconstruction comes to an end. And so Reconstruction ends in about 1877, and this was really the violent overthrow of this black political regime in Charleston by white supremacists, by people who were carrying out violence like the Klan. And so it's at that point that we start to see a real shift in how slavery is remembered in Charleston and South Carolina. And this is when we start to move to these more whitewashed memories, where white Charlestonians, white South Carolinians are able to say, no, slavery wasn't that important. No, it didn't cause the Civil War. No, it wasn't all that bad.
When did the monuments that we now have so much in the news and the headlines last year and even into 2018 now, when did they start going up? Is that a more 20th century phenomena, or what's the history of that?
That's a great question, and something that's often misunderstood when you in the context of the current debates over monuments. People miss the fact that they did not go up immediately after the Civil War. It was decades after the Civil War. It was after this, what's called redemption, the end of Reconstruction in the South that Blaine was talking about, that you know, Reconstruction really comes to a close formally in the end of the 1870s, and it's really not until the late 1880s into the 1890s that you see the an upsurge, a huge surge in monument building. And that first major wave sort of crests by the second decade of the 20th century. So 1890s to 1920s is when you see most Confederate monuments erected across the South and even in other places beyond the South. There'd be a second sort of wave that hits the United States in the 1950s and 60s. And these were the time period matters. The first wave was at the coincided directly with the rise of Jim Crow. The you know, implementation of thorough racial segregation, the implementation of voting, disenfranchisement of African American voters. They at the same time were erecting monuments saying that you know, white people are superior. We're looking back at a Confederate past, that we're showing you who our heroes are, reminding African Americans not only are they second class citizens, but the Civil War wasn't really about them.
Blaine, you're both historians, and the city of Charleston is known across the country for its great historic preservation and many of the historic buildings that are there. Of course, the city did not burn in the Civil War like many others in the South did. One reason that accounts for that historic architecture that remains there today. You write in the book that also has... there's also a racial element there as well. Tell me a little more about that and how that fits into your chronicling this issue.
Sure. Well, Charleston was really at the forefront of historic preservation nationally. There were quite a few civic leaders, many of them women, who in the early 20th century looked around and said, many of our buildings are in danger of being destroyed or just falling down. There actually was not a lot of money in Charleston in the early 20th century. A lot of that wealth had gone away at the end of the Civil War. And so these civic organizations looked around and said, we need to try to preserve some of these old churches, municipal buildings, and homes. And to their credit, they were able to do this. They raised money, they rehabilitated homes, they opened them to the public. And while that's important, it's also really, I think, imperative for us to understand that there is a racial component to that, because the types of buildings that were preserved were the domains of wealthy white Charlestonians. And what was not preserved and what was not interpreted for all the tourists who were coming to Charleston were things like slave dwellings, slave quarters, the kitchens where slaves would have worked. And this mattered. I mean, Charleston sold itself as America's most historic city. It marketed itself that way, and millions of Americans traveled to Charleston really throughout much of the 20th century, and they continue to do so today. And so those decisions that were made in the early 20th century really continue to have ramifications for how visitors understand the history of the city and the history of the South more generally.
And just to, if I can pick up on that, one of the things that first struck us when we started working on this book, we moved to Charleston in 2005, and we would wander around the city. It sells itself as this historical mecca, but the history of slavery was nowhere present. There are no monuments to slavery. The buildings are beautifully preserved, but they don't talk on the tours you would take about the enslaved. And as historians, as American historians, we knew well Charleston's history, and that's one of the things we like to underscore in the book is how central that we call Charleston America's capital of slavery, the capital of American slavery, because it was. More than half of the enslaved people brought from Africa to the United States came through the port of Charleston. That's about 200,000 people. It was a thriving center of the domestic slave trade that removes tens of thousands of people just from Charleston to the Southwest. It was the center of the intellectual and political fight to protect slavery, to defend slavery as a positive good, as John Calhoun famously said. And it was the place where the Civil War started, where the secessionists first held their first secessionist convention, the South Carolina Secession Convention in 1860. That's in December of 1860. It's held in Charleston. That's where the Civil War begins, a war to preserve slavery. And this was entirely lost. Things have changed over the last decade, but that was one of the sort of main impetus for us to write this book.
Things have changed over the last decade, but in some ways things haven't. This issue has sparked again nationally with white nationalists marching in the street, some affiliates of Nazi parties marching in the street recently. I imagine this, knowing how long it takes to do a project like this, that you began this book before the recent event events in Charlottesville, but tell me about how that impacted your work.
Sure. Well, you are right. We started this research years ago. In fact, we really kind of became interested in it when we moved to Charleston in 2005. We lived there for 2 years until 2007 before coming to Fresno. And yes, recent events really, of course, precipitated by the Emanuel massacre, when white supremacist Dylann Roof murdered 9 parishioners at Emanuel AME Church almost 3 years ago now. The real kind of contemporary relevance of these questions came to the fore nationally. How we remember slavery, Whether or not we remember slavery really became a national conversation. But one of the things that we're really trying to prove with this book is that this is a conversation that's been going on in Charleston for 150 years. In a place that was the capital of American slavery, in a place where the Civil War began, they've been debating these issues. So in some ways, it's not really new. On the other hand, it's kind of become more of a national headline since the Emanuel Massacre. And I think that one of the things we're seeing is how entrenched these ideas are nationally, not just in the South. We've all seen headlines about how there are monuments in Western states, in Northern states. And so we see communities well beyond the South grappling with the memory of slavery and the memory of Civil War. And that's kind of another theme of our book. While much of this starts in the South, these become national issues. The kind of propaganda that ends up coming out of a place like Charleston has widespread national ramifications. So to give you an example, there was just a study released a couple of months ago by the Southern Poverty Law Center revealing that only 8% of high school seniors nationally can identify or do identify slavery as the cause of the Civil War. That's not a regional statistic. That's a national statistic. And so this kind of memory making that was going on in a place like Charleston has real national ramifications.
Yeah, and you can see that even if you, I've experienced that, frankly, not too long after we moved here to Fresno. I teach the Civil War, teach classes on the Civil War, and I was asked to write an opinion piece by the Fresno State newspaper editor. It ultimately got picked up by the Fresno Bee, and it was really a reflection on the annual Civil War reenactment that happens every fall here. And I wrote pretty honestly that as a Civil War historian, I'm of two minds about these reenactments. You know, on the one hand, students come into my classroom every year saying how much it sort of grabbed their imagination. It got them interested in history. It got them interested in the Civil War in particular. And I love that. And anything that gets students to come and take history classes, I think, is fantastic. But at the same time, you know, these Civil War reenactments, like, they don't do it to the same degree, I think, as, say, monuments used to or lost cause defenders over time have in terms of whitewashing the memory of slavery. But on the whole, most reenactments tend to push larger ideas about why the Civil War happened, what it meant, to the side and focus on kind of what I would say is military minutia. Not that it's totally insignificant, but it matters far less how exactly people marched than what's the larger significance of the Civil War? What brought it on? What were the larger outcomes of the Civil War? And those get lost a lot of times at these reenactments, and as a result, they kind of bolster this lost cause amnesia that Blaine's talking about with this recent SPLC report.
Mm-hmm. Blaine, before we go, you mentioned that this has been a dialogue that's been going on for 150 years in Charleston. With that in mind, what can we take away from that dialogue and from Charleston's own divisions and tensions on that issue for the present day?
Well, I think one thing that I would really like to emphasize is that today, people who defend Confederate monuments, who say, no, they're good history, we need to leave them up, the Civil War was not about slavery, those folks, when they get into conversation, tend to say things like, well, you know, you're just criticizing them because you're trying to be PC. They talk about this as a manifestation of some kind of contemporary politically correct movement. What the historical record shows is that this is not new. This is not about political correctness. The historical record shows that slavery was central to our history, that it was inhumane, that it was built on violence. And when you look at Charleston, you can see that the memory of the institution from the earliest days after the Civil War really focused on that fact. And so if you look at the long history, what you can see is that this conversation that we are having today and our attempt to get the reality of slavery told, this is not a manifestation of political correctness. This is simply an honoring of the accuracy of the historical record.
Ethan?
And it's I think, something that can change very quickly. It is an old conversation, but this conversation has shifted dramatically in the last few years. And to me, that suggests that sometimes we get depressed thinking about how little has changed, how we can still have these terrible statistics like 92% of high school seniors not understanding the causes of the Civil War. But at the same time, we've seen it was a horrendous tragedy. It's certainly not something we wish would have happened, but maybe, as we write about at the end of our book, maybe the saving grace of that awful Emanuel massacre is that we are having this conversation in a way that was not imaginable, I would say, certainly to me, beforehand. The idea that we would, the idea that South Carolina would take down its Confederate flag that had been flying on Statehouse grounds since the 1960s, just a month after that tragic incident, suggests that that change is possible, and I think that we have to have change on these issues. That we have to reckon with this part of our past.
The book is called Denmark Vesey's Garden: Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy, a 150-year reckoning with America's original sin, looking at the history of the way that we talk about the Civil War and slavery and its legacy in the context of the city of Charleston, South Carolina, where the Civil War began. It is by Fresno State history professors Ethan J. Keitel and Blaine Roberts. We're so pleased to have them joining us today. You can find the book wherever books are sold. Ethan and Blaine, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.